Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up for tonight. We'll hear from Leo Panitch, who is a professor of political science at York University in Toronto and author of the cover story in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy magazine, of all places, a very staid and establishment magazine. But they asked Leo Panitch to write about Marx and why he seems to be relevant today. So we'll hear from Leo on how that happened and what it all means. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Jackson Lears, who is a professor of history at Rutgers and author of the book Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, from the post-Civil War period into the early part of the 20th century. And a central theme of that book is the role of Protestantism, particularly the American variety of Protestantism and its notions of rebirth and regeneration, a lot of it, unfortunately, through violence, racial, imperial, and economic violence, which some people found a form of regeneration. So we'll hear from Jackson Lears on that. But first, a few comments on the economic news. Got to keep them short, since there's a lot of interview material ahead. Because Friday is a holiday, we got the June employment report a day earlier than usual, and the news wasn't very good. So much for last month's hint of an improving trend. There's almost nothing encouraging buried in the innards of this month's employment report. June's headline job loss of 467,000 looks good only in comparison to the awful numbers we saw earlier this year and late last, but it's still quite bad. Losses were widespread throughout the major economic sectors, with manufacturing and construction down hard once again, but with major service sectors like retail and finance also taking significant hits. Healthcare was up, but only a little bit, much less than we're used to seeing from that indefatigable sector. Even government lost jobs, though most of that loss came from the layoff of temporary census workers. I saw one of those a few weeks ago strolling through my Brooklyn neighborhood with a handheld device, checking addresses in preparation for mailing out the forms next year, but I'm guessing he's joined the ranks of the unemployed now. The yearly loss in overall employment in percentage terms is the worst since 1958, the loss in private services the worst ever. We've lost 6.5 million jobs since the recession began in December 2007, and the employment level is now below the peak reached in 2001. We've never had a recession completely undo the job gains of the previous expansion since the end of World War II. But the gains during that expansion were extremely feeble. Employment growth so far this decade, climbing the expansion and the recessions, has been just 0.1% a year. Since the end of World War II, we've never seen a decade in which growth averaged less than almost 2%. The share of the adult population working, which had gone seriously into reverse last year, is now back to 1984 levels. The unemployment rate rose 0.1 point to 9.5%, a modest increase by recent standards, but it's now at its highest level since 1983. Thursday morning's unemployment claims figures, both for people filing for the first time after losing their jobs and for those continuing to draw benefits, were mildly encouraging, but there's still little serious sign of an end to the misery in the job market. But not on Wall Street. Today's Wall Street Journal reports that big pay packages are back. One happy banker exclaimed that it's like 2007 all over again. I hope they're courteous enough to send a thank you card to Barack Obama, without whom none of this could have happened. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to hear about Marx.
When Karl Marx was a boy, he took a hard look around. He saw people were starving all over the place, while others were painting the town. A public-spirited boy became a public-spirited man. So he worked very hard and he read everything, until he came up with the plan. There'd be no exploitation, the worker always clean. No discrimination, 'cause the color of your skin. No more private property, you would not be allowed. No one could rise too high, no one could sink too low, or go under completely, like some we all know. If Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. And if I had him here in my mansion on the hill, I'd tell him a story, it would give his old heart a chill. It's something that happened to me.
And that's some of Randy Newman's The World Isn't Fair, a song to Karl Marx. And speaking of Karl Marx, Leo Panitch, who's a professor of political science at York University, a frequent guest on Behind the News, has a piece in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy, which they asked him to write, on why Marx is important today. I was rather surprised by all this, and I think Leo was too. So I gave him a call and asked him what was up. Leo Panitch. Okay, welcome, Leo. My first question about your piece in Foreign Policy is, how'd that come to be? It's normally a very establishment and kind of dull journal.
Yes, it was rather astonishing. My publisher in London was contacted, and they asked if they could get hold of me and my co-editor on the Socialist Register, Colin Lees, to see whether we would write a piece on What Would Marx Say Today. Colin demurred from doing it, and I thought, well, you know, when Foreign Policy asks you to write such a thing, one should take advantage of it. So I wrote something up, and, you know, I didn't really think they'd even publish it because I didn't pull any punches and, you know, said very explicitly that Marx wouldn't be giving any advice to capitalist governments in this crisis, but he'd be telling people who are now socially isolated to get together and make a revolution, which is what I think he would have done. And they not only published it, but they went gaga over it. And said it was one of the greatest pieces they've ever had, blah, 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 and lo and behold, they put it on the cover.
And a strange cover it is, with Marx made it of bread and potatoes.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very arresting cover, I think. It's a very pomo piece of art. And I don't know that they had, it may well be that they decided to put the piece on the cover because it was such an arresting piece of art. But, of course, it gives the message that while we are taking Marx seriously by putting this piece in the issue, the cover is, you know, a bit, don't take him too seriously.
Yes, my three-year-old pronounces it crazy, so I don't know who the intended audience is exactly. But what do you make of their interest? Have you seen this kind of interest in Marx in previous economic crises?
Not to this extent, no. I think I haven't. That's a good question. I haven't quite thought about it that way. Certainly not at the turn of the century. And given that the 1990-91 recession occurred right in the wake of 1989 and the collapse of authoritarian communism, and most journalists tend to think that Marx had something to do with that authoritarian system, which he would have abhorred and condemned, there was nothing then either. So, yeah, I think that this is something new. It both has to do with the extent of the crisis, but I think it also has to do with the gloss being off neoliberalism, the fact that it's now so obvious that one can be capital C communist and have nothing to do whatever with Marx, the Chinese elite that is, you know, mendaciously pursuing capitalism in China. Are communists, but you can imagine what Marx would think about them. So I think both the depth of the crisis and the fact that we're 20 years on from this association between Marx and communist dictatorships probably provides the opening for this.
I was surprised to see that even Foreign Policy even included a sidebar with a list of recommended readings, including some rather obscure journals.
And they consulted me on it, and, you know, in terms of what I thought should be in there and so on. They didn't put in everything I thought that should. They had some rather old-fashioned stuff. But nevertheless, I mean, I think that was interesting. Now, this said, I think it wouldn't be the case if this were a piece of Stalinist Marxism that they were being given. I don't think they'd pay attention to it. So I think partly what's going on is that Marxism is not dead, and it's not fossilized, certainly not in its old Marxist-Leninist mode. Which was always only a current in terms of any serious Marxist analysis. You know, so I think the reason they liked it was that what I was writing reflected the kind of Marxism that has been flourishing, really, not in the sense of there being a mass audience, but in the sense of a fair number of people working to develop Marxism so that it's relevant to the understanding of capitalism as it evolves into the 21st century. And that's one of the things I think that probably surprised them.
Well, you touched on something which is an important problem, which is that this kind of Marxism you're talking about is being developed by academics and intellectuals mostly, and not any kind of mass movement.
That's true, but not, you know, necessarily entirely divorced from the world either. But, you know, with Z Magazine, or Z Magazine, as you Americans say, and ZNet, you know, that is intended to be popular and does reach a good many young people. So, and I, you know, one could point to many other examples of this. So I don't think it's just rarefied taking place in the ivory tower either. And I do think that there's a lot of young people who operate with a whole new set of concepts that have been developed since the 1970s in the way they think about class, in the way they think about finance, partly because of you, Doug, if I can give you a plug. But you know, in general, in terms of how they use a creative Marxism. And I think part of the kind of sneering postmodernist, post-structuralist attitude to Marxism, which was so much based on a notion of it being a fossilized teleology, a lot of young people have learned that, you know, that really isn't on. And I would suspect that the young people who work for Moses Naim at Foreign Policy, you know, saw this as fresh and were excited by it for that reason. Critical, but yet fresh.
So what does Marx bring to an analysis of the current crisis or the current conjuncture, as they say, around New Left Review that other modes of analysis are lacking?
Well, I think we have to be careful here. You know, I had to actually fight with them at Foreign Policy to not let them change my language so that it would appear that Marx fully anticipated this particular crisis, or that his analysis mainly focused on financial crises. You know, this is what they would hope I would say, of course, and it isn't true. And I had to fight back from them editing it in such a way that it would say this, which would be very simplistic. Marx didn't mainly focus on financial crises, although he, of course, identified them and analyzed the ones that he saw taking place in his time in a brilliant way. But he was mainly much more focusing on crises that were rooted in and even sparked by developments in production and in commodity competition. He wasn't primarily an analyst of financial crises at the core of his theory. So, I don't think one should make too much of Marx having seen all of this. And part of the developments in Marxism, which both you and I, Doug, have been working on for many years, has been to try to understand the increasing role that finance plays in a functional way in capitalism, not just a speculation.
Yeah, and of course a lot of Marxists over the last century or so have sort of treated finance as marginal or secondary.
Exactly. Whether Marx did to the extent they have is another question, But they have, and that was wrong. I think it's very important to realize there isn't one Marx and one Marxism, certainly not. What he has to say that's relevant, however, is I think that you read Marx and you first of all understand that capitalism is a very competitive and dynamic system. And by virtue of that degree of competition and dynamism, there is not, in fact, some hidden hand that produces an equilibrium in this market-driven society, but that it is a system that is inherently crisis-prone. That doesn't mean it breaks down and is over when it comes into crises. But, you know, Marx's understanding of contradiction, that is, that the very things that make the system dynamic and grow are also at work in such a way that they also produce crises in it. There's no inherent tendency to equilibrium in this system. And if you have that kind of understanding of the world we live in, then I think you're on the way to understanding key things about it. And that's really crucial. And a lot, you know, both in terms of what most economists don't do, who walk around with this notion of equilibrium and the hidden hand operating behind the market, but also in terms of post-structuralists and post-Marxists and post-modernists who are disdainful of the material and who have, you know, spend their time, and they're not speaking of discourse and culture, and they've made great contributions to that, but they really ignored the political economy that we all have to live in order to subsist. And I think they've been brought back to, with a bang, to reality by this current crisis. And Marxism is very important and valuable for that. And I think a lot of those radical people who have been culturalists are now going to be paying more attention to the political economic. And for that, what Marx has to tell us is crucial. If I can mention one other thing, it is, of course, the class dimension that is in Marxism, that Marxism points to as important. You know, the fact that one needs a class map, even if the one that Marx was operating with is out of date. In order to understand the world, you need a class map in terms of, who's making the decisions about what's produced, where it's produced, what's invested, how it's invested, etc. And you need a class map in terms of who's at the exploited end of this or the marginalized end of it. And you need a class map to understand how finance has even incorporated those people into the system in such a way that produces contradictions like the prime mortgage market. Marxism has a lot that's valuable just to understand the world. You know, it's actually less valuable in some ways in turn for us at the current moment in terms of how to change it, except in terms of the fact that it's ambitious. You know, that it invites one to think ambitiously about a better world, about the possibility of a different kind of world. And the cramped thinking of liberals and social democrats, which is always policy-oriented in terms of how can we fix things rather than in terms of how can we create a different kind of world. Marxism induces one to think ambitiously and strategically in relation to that ambition, and that also is very, very valuable.
I'm speaking with Leo Panitch, who's a professor of political science at York University in Toronto and author of a piece on Marx in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy. Going back to the issue, the point of immateriality, the students of immateriality have a point in a world in which some of the most prominent symbols of capitalism now are things like credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations. Things are very difficult to describe, much less understand. But this is, in some sense, capitalism has created this prominence of immateriality.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what the culturalists are talking about at all. I think they were talking about discourse and language in a way that invited the conception that the internet was in some sense not a material thing, that invited the conception that computer games or video games or Hollywood films are not material things, are not commodities, that there isn't production that goes into them. Although I think this gets very murky, I think there are certain financial services that, if not quite commodities, nevertheless are functional to globalization. That is that, while what you're describing is indeed, you know, these credit derivative swaps, etc., are indeed very murky and are things that are very fungible and don't even involve any paper. They're simply commitments that people make to each other in a hedged kind of way. Those things are related to real material requirements. That is, you know, given that someone is producing something in Upper New York State that they're going to sell to China next October or deliver to China next October, and that somebody in Beijing is producing something that's going to have to be delivered to New York State next October, and you live in a world of floating exchange rates and fluctuating interest rates and changing transportation prices and changing governments so that laws may change in the interim. What is really going on with this stuff is an attempt to hedge the risk involved when you sign a contract. There's nothing particularly new about this. This goes all the way back to what the Chicago Mercantile Exchange was set up for in the 1870s in terms of trying to provide some hedging of risk on what the price of wheat would be for North American farmers and other commodities. Now it's globalization as such that we're producing on such an integrated scale around the globe that, you know, what's taking place in this respect is to some extent, functional to very material exchanges. And even then, even when it's just about finance, I mean, part of it is about, you know, people with mortgages, you know, being able to or being given instruments with which they can also hedge their risks over what interest rates will be in the future. Now, true, this is, of course, in the hands of and manipulated by a relatively small number of people in very few centers in the world, centered around Wall Street, with its satellite in London. And it's certainly the case that what this reflects, that the decisions around this, the game is being played by, you know, a relatively small number of people in institutions that are accountable to no one. Insofar as they are accountable to anyone, they are, you know, in cahoots with those they're accountable to, whether it's the SEC or the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know, they interchange personnel constantly. They're really one ruling class, to use a term that you're using these days, Doug. And that's a scandal. I mean, that too, I think, reflects Marx's great insight that we live in a world, whether finance or production, that is increasingly socialized. In the sense that we're all tied to one another through these massive and very powerful institutions of corporations and banks. But they're privately owned. It's astonishing. The world is socialized. It can't exist without these institutions functioning, and that's why the government runs in to bail them out. And yet they are in private hands. And it's just a matter of being a Democrat, not a matter of necessarily being a Marxist, where one wants to say, how can this be?
We've only got a minute or two left, but I want to conclude on this note. You quote, in the piece you quote Marx and Engels from the Manifesto, saying, "The united action of leading countries, at least, is the first condition for the emancipation of the proletariat." Now, over the last several decades, a lot of Marxists in the richer countries have despaired of any kind of action by their proletariat leading to that sort of thing, and have looked to revolutionary movements in the Third World for leadership. And even now, we're looking to Latin America in the Northern Hemisphere for some sort of leadership. Is there any kind of real transformation of the political and economic system possible without what Marx called the leading countries taking the lead?
I think not. That's not to say that the spark may not occur outside of the advanced capitalist countries. And I think that a lot of creative organizing does take place in certain parts of the world outside of those countries, and often is emulated then in the West. But I think unless change takes place in the advanced capitalist countries, unless, in fact, there is a very different type of struggle from below taking place at the center of the world economy, which is the American empire, unless there's change taking place in the United States that would sustain the change taking place elsewhere, then I think we're not going to get very far. Of course, I say this as a Canadian, where it's most obvious. You know, we can only go so far in any development that takes place of a fundamental orientation towards change unless there are similar developments taking place in the United States. You know, I think one needs to define the word proletariat differently, perhaps, than Marx did, much more broadly, much more flexibly. I think one has to have patience. I think there are developments in the United States that are very hopeful in this respect. I look at what's happening in some of the workers' action centers. And I must say, the Marxism that is inspiring a good many of them and the way they talk to one another about the need for a socialist party in the United States, not immediately to engage in elections, but to the end of stepping out of their parochial concerns in San Francisco or Miami or where have you, learning from each other, developing a leadership that will be responsive to a broader constituency than the ones they just can be responsible to in their workers' action centers. You know, I think there's a lot more going on in your country than most people realize. And you know, one has to have patience. This is a very, very powerful system, despite the crisis we're in. It's powerful culturally and ideologically and materially because people are so dependent on it They're so plugged into it, including into the finance. But the contradictions in it are such as we see today, that I'm confident that there is going to be radical movements for change, even in the United States. And unless there will be in the United States, I don't think we're going to see any fundamental change in the 21st century.
And that was the voice of Leo Panitch, a professor of political science at York University, co-editor of the Socialist Register, the annual journal, and author of the cover story in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy magazine on the relevance of Karl Marx. And strange venue to see something like that. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 in your FM dial, and on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit that website, why don't you mosey on over and hit that donate button, because we could always use your pennies and dollars. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the rebirth of the United States after the Civil War. That was some of Night Fantasies by Elliot Carter, performed by Ursula Oppens. I think I neglected to say my name is Doug Henwood and the program is Behind the News, so I'll do that right now. And next up, we're going to hear an interview with Jackson Lears, who is a prolific author, author of many stylish and readable and intelligent histories of the United States that mix culture, economics, and politics in a very fruitful and interesting way. His latest book is Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, 1877 to 1920, just out from Harper. He's also a professor of history at Rutgers University and editor of the journal Raritan. Okay, Jackson Lears. Welcome, Jackson Lears. The U.S. at the end of the Civil War was a pretty ravaged place. Could you describe the landscape for us?
Well, farmers were turning up a lot of skulls in their cornfields in places like Virginia especially, and, of course, throughout a lot of the South. Fields were ravaged, and farms were burned down, and there wasn't a whole lot of promise in the landscape south of the Mason-Dixon line. It was pretty burned over, that entire part of the country, and of course the rest of the country had suffered too in terms of casualties. We're talking about over 600,000 deaths alone, not to mention countless thousands of maimed and injured men who carried both their bodily and their emotional and psychological scars around with them for decades afterwards. So if we think about how much trauma the Vietnam War left in our public discourse and how bitterly it was still being debated 30 years after the fall of Saigon, and we multiply that by the casualties suffered in the Civil War and the bitterness on both sides, and I think we have a sense of how important that war was to the shaping of American culture in the late 19th century.
During the war, though, there was a considerable enthusiasm on both sides for a total war, a total attitude of destruction of the enemy, right?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that accounted for the ferocity of the attacks on both sides and the long duration of the war as well. The fact that the struggle went on for 4 years, much longer than, of course, anyone had anticipated at the outset, which is usually what happens in wars. It's a combination of romantic nationalism and evangelical Protestantism, I think, that created this sort of toxic brew that both sides got drunk on it, actually. And the North just happened to have more technological power, more more men, more capacity to lay waste to the other side. The Southerners wanted to do the same thing to the North, but they didn't have the capability to do it. So in the end, they paid the price. And Grant's tactics, which were to grind down the opponents in a war of attrition, were what carried the day. But they did so, of course, at a fearful price to his own men as well as the Confederate side.
That toxic brew of romantic nationalism and Protestantism that you talk about, though, pervades your book and indeed much of American history. So could you elaborate on that some?
Sure. Well, the title itself comes from my recognition that the Protestant longing for rebirth, which is really at the core of American culture in the 19th century, leads to all sorts of secular expressions as well. The desire to remake oneself, to reinvent oneself, takes many different forms, from bodybuilding and psychotherapy, both of which emerge in this period, to more social and political forms, such as the Prohibition movement to ban the drinking of alcohol, which was really about regenerating the entire nation and liberating it from the bondage to drink. And ultimately, to social Christianity, which underlay both populism and even more progressivism, the desire to create the kingdom of God on earth in the image of a kind of cooperative commonwealth, to overcome the war of all against all in capitalism and create a more peaceful commonweal. This is the most benign expression of the desire for rebirth, the one that leads to the foundations of the welfare state. But in some ways, the more powerful and enduring expression of it is the one that leads to the battlefield and to imperial adventures in particular. And this is where figures like Theodore Roosevelt and Oliver Wendell Holmes and others come in, men who either experienced the Civil War, as Holmes did, or who fantasized about recreating the conditions for heroic struggle, as Teddy Roosevelt did. And, of course, that fantasy leads Roosevelt up San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War, leading the charge of the Rough Riders. But it also leads him into the Caribbean and Latin America and into advocacy for American entry into World War I. And finally, we have a figure like Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, who in many ways presents what you might call the kind of humanitarian interventionism of his time. He's a man who really hated war, and like Roosevelt, he did not see war as an opportunity for masculine rebirth. And there's always, of course, a huge gender dimension to this, I should point out. He wanted to go to war only because he convinced himself that this could be a war to end all war. And, of course, that turned out to be a delusion. But that is the grandiose dream that carried him forward.
I want to return to Teddy Roosevelt and the themes of empire in a moment, but at the end of the Civil War, the relations between black and white in the South were very different from what they would be 20 years later. Could you describe that trajectory of some kind of fellow feeling between the white and black in the South to a regime of Jim Crow and lynching?
Sure. Well, I think it's too easy to see Jim Crow and the segregation system as just a kind of foreordained outcome. And in fact, it was only installed with great difficulty and over several decades of struggle. And black people fought heroically to maintain their foothold in public life, and they succeeded in many ways. And part of the reason they succeeded is that race relations maintained a certain kind of fluidity in everyday life, particularly in the rural South. Black people and white people worked together. They helped each other out when in times of sickness or other kinds of need. They worked together. They delivered babies, each other's babies. And they sometimes even partied together if they were working men on a spree after a long day at a lumber camp or a sawmill. So there's I don't want to create a utopian image of a biracial society in perfect harmony, but what I do think we see is the kind of afterglow of Reconstruction, when the radical Republicans, when they were still the party of Lincoln and they were still trying to put together a genuinely redistributed program of equal justice in the South that included poor whites as well as poor blacks. So there were reasons why white and black people mingled more easily for a time in the 1870s and on into the 1880s. And even in the 1890s, you still find in states like North Carolina large numbers of black office holders and fusion tickets, as they were called, between white populace and black Republicans, who managed to get remarkably progressive legislation passed for the time, and the kind of regime, the kind of civil rights policies that you don't see in the South again until the 1960s, and sometimes not even then. So there is this period, but what happens, of course, is that the men who call themselves redeemers, this is another form of redemption and rebirth from the point of view of the white elites, they begin to claw their way back to power, and they do it with, you know, familiar racist hate-mongering and conjuring up fears among the white population of the supposedly ferocious and rapacious black beast who is on the prowl as a result of black freedom. The argument becomes that freed slaves can't handle freedom, and they're retrogressing to savagery. And this argument acquires tremendous legitimacy. You have people like Nathaniel Southgate Shaler, who's a Harvard geologist, writing in the Atlantic Monthly and similar magazines, defending this idea. So racism acquires scientific respectability in this period, and in many ways is twinned with modernity and with ideas of purifying not only the race, but also the polity by eliminating the disruptive elements and the backward elements, which of course include African Americans primarily, but also a good many poor whites, and sometimes in northern cities, immigrant groups as well, particularly those from southern and eastern Europe. So there's a pervasive racism in this period, north and south, and it of course acquires particularly virulent form in the South, and the most virulent form is the pervasiveness of lynching, which reaches heights not seen before or since in the 1890s and after the turn of the century. And, you know, lynching is a kind of ritual of racial regeneration for the white community, and often it is staged by the elite of the town. It's not a group of rabble here. It's not something that's coming from the bottom up, but it is the white elite basically orchestrating a ritual of regeneration that ties the rest of white society to them. It creates bonds of loyalty, as white people can stick together even if they have vast class differences when they're reminding one another that whatever else they are, they're white, and they have that in common. And that becomes a tremendous source of elite power in the South in particular, and to a lesser extent throughout the whole country, because you also have similar kinds of struggles going on in the West against the Chinese and against Jews and Italians and other more recent immigrant groups in the Northeast. So it's a period of almost incandescent racism in this society, and it's a period at the end of which to be an American is almost by definition to be a Caucasian.
I should say, I'm speaking with Jackson Lears, who's the author of Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, just out from Harper. You have a striking passage in the book where you say that this was the political vision of southern elites and their northern counterparts, a deferential society run by crony cliques in the interest of capital. The role of the state in creating this social structure cannot be underestimated. That certainly is at odds with the notion of a self-governing democracy, isn't it?
It certainly is, as well as with certain free market mythologies with which we're no doubt familiar. I mean, the state is critical to creating this elite hegemony in the late 19th century, whether it's through tariffs or other subsidies or creating right-of-ways for railroads or simply through the compliance of state legislatures who've been successfully bribed by the likes of John D. Rockefeller and his contemporaries.
Yeah, I want to talk about Rockefeller, too, because this was also the period of the Gilded Age, the second part of the 19th century. There's this kind of twin ideology of one of Protestant virtue, hard work, honesty, straightforwardness. Rockefeller embodied that, but publicly, but also in privately, he was manipulating and bribing and doing all sorts of nasty things. And American economic history, you know, more broadly, is a long series of securities frauds and speculations and all kinds of things that we in recent history think of as very, very contemporary, but in fact go way back. What about these contradictory strands of economic thought and behavior?
Well, I think there's a real core theme in this book, at least with respect to the economic history, and that is that the key to success in life is capital, not labor. The mythology of the time, and the one that business elites promoted, was, of course, that hard work was the only way to success. You make your own luck, etc. But in fact, if you look at figures like Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and others, these are men who become very successful through stock manipulations, often based on insider trading. In Carnegie's case, he was a great pal of Tom Scott, who was the CEO of the Pennsylvania Railroad at the time, and he attached himself to Scott, and he basically made his career early on out of being a crony of Scott's. And he was already a wealthy man by the time he recognized that this was a great moment to move from iron to steel in Pittsburgh. So he was in the right place at the right time, but he also had the capital in his pocket to make that investment. He could then turn into, of course, the company that became the first billion-dollar corporation in the world, United States Steel Corporation, after the turn of the century. But in every case, there is this capacity among the men like Rockefeller and Carnegie to recognize that you have to use money to make money. Of course, they themselves were hard workers. They loved what they did, and Rockefeller was almost frighteningly disciplined and almost parodically a Protestant in his everyday life. So you might or might not be a figure who embodied the Protestant ethic, and that of course could help you get where you wanted to get. But it wasn't always necessary. I mean, if you look at somebody like J.P. Morgan, he's an embodiment of sybaritic luxury and leisure. You know, he's got multiple mistresses, and of course he's got a gargantuan appetite, not only for food and wine, but also for objet d'art throughout the world. And so you have, again, a man, though, who knows how to be in the right place at the right time, especially with respect to making money multiply. And this is what I refer to as the mysterious power of money that Americans, or certainly a handful of a few fortunate ones, are beginning to discover at this time. And it doesn't, of course, always square with Protestant virtue, but that's the ideology that excuses and indeed justifies this kind of behavior. But there's also a great deal of suspicion of this mysterious power of money on the part of people who call themselves the producing classes, whether they're artisanal workers or farmers or others who actually work with their hands and believe with Marx in the labor theory of value, and that is that the real source of wealth should be and is, in their judgment, human labor. So these are the people who begin to view the Wall Street financiers as parasites on the body politic. That is, people who are actually preying on the hard work of the masses like themselves. And so they are the ones who begin to demand antitrust, breaking up corporations into smaller divisions, and at the same time more regulation of capital and a more open credit system that would benefit people like themselves. And so there's a tremendous plasticity to the American social order in this period. There are times when it doesn't look like there's even going to be a social order much longer. The elites have an image they keep returning to that they call the volcano under the city. They're expecting for this thing to erupt any moment. And there's a tremendous fear on the part of elites, and also a tremendous longing on the part of the lower orders for a deep social transformation. And of course, what comes out of this is not a revolution, but a kind of gigantic compromise that is progressive reform.
Yeah, we've just come through what in many ways feels like a second Gilded Age, but without the Knights of Labor and without the populace, people forget that the latter part of the 19th century was a time of tremendous political ferment.
Well, that's right, and in fact, this is what leads to the foundations of the welfare state and the extent to which reformers begin to tame capitalism and to make it something other than just a regime of raw power, which is what it is for much of the 19th century, the latter part of the 19th century especially. And it's pressure from groups like the Knights of Labor and the populace that ultimately gets translated into legislation. Of course, it's watered down by comparison with what they might have wanted, and labor unions don't achieve anything like the kind of power in this period that they enjoy later on in the 1930s, especially with respect to unskilled workers. Nevertheless, I think it's a period of tremendous pressure from below. You can see it even in terms of the Federal Reserve System, the fact that the Federal Reserve System gets created in 1913 at all, and that it has any kind of public dimension. It has these branches outside New York City, for example. All of these things are indications that the government, the progressive reform government of Woodrow Wilson, is trying to not only satisfy the investment bankers, with whom they are on quite cordial terms, but also to satisfy the demands of the population, and particularly the southern and western agrarian population, for a more flexible money supply and a more publicly managed credit system that actually serves the needs of the majority of the people and not just a handful of bondholders and bankers. So there is a tremendous period of pressure from below. Whether we'll see the same kind of pressure in our current state of affairs remains to be seen, of course, and it's much more difficult now, I think. And we've just been through 30 years of tremendous and relentless celebration of free market capitalism, the supposed self-correcting mechanisms that we are supposed to see kick in at any moment now are just not kicking in. And the role of government has been denigrated so thoroughly for so long that a lot of people think they're being populist when they criticize the government. And in fact, the populists, the original populists anyway, were some of the chief architects of government intervention in the economy. In many ways, they were sort of proto-Keynesians in their belief in a flexible money supply, for example.
And one other aspect of the turn of the last century was an emergence of an American empire. How does that fit in with the theme of Protestant regeneration, rebirth you're talking about?
Well, I really think it's central. Actually, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I was very troubled at the time of the invasion of Iraq, and in fact during the whole post 9/11 period, with the revival of talk about American empire and the tendency of Brits like Neil Ferguson and others to lecture us on our imperial responsibilities, how we Americans really needed to pick up the white man's burden and start running with it now that the British had so unceremoniously dropped it. And the whole tendency to see American empire as an exalted role that we could play in the world and as a way of intervening in the sacred drama of world history in accordance with God's will. I mean, all of this was coming out of Bush's White House at the time of the invasion of Iraq, and accounted for his certainty and his much-heralded serenity about the outcome of that mission, and troubled me a great deal, and I wanted to try to explore the roots of this mentality, and I think you can find them in the Civil War, and especially the decades after the Civil War, when figures like Theodore Roosevelt, who is truly the ideological ancestor of George W. Bush, at least as far as imperial adventures are concerned, Roosevelt comes along, and you know his own father has bought his way out of the Civil War, bought a substitute for himself in the draft, and Theodore is tremendously upset by this and embarrassed.
Bit of a reversal of the Bush father and son, probably.
Yeah, that's right, very much so. And Teddy feels like he needs to make up for this, so he really begins to sanctify physical struggle and and particularly military heroism as the real making of a man. And he's not alone in this. Of course, manhood is, masculinity is always in crisis, I like to say, but the crisis expresses itself in different ways at different historical moments. And in the late 19th century, it expresses itself as a preoccupation with the need to recover physical testing. So you opportunities for physical testing in dangerous situations. And you can do this by exploring the Arctic regions, as a lot of upper-class young men do. Once upon a time, you could do it on the frontier, according to the mythology of the time, but as Frederick Jackson Turner reminds everyone, in the early 1890s, the frontier is closed, so that aspect of making American manhood is no longer available. So Roosevelt comes along and says, wait a minute, you know, we can go out into the world and not only expand our commercial opportunities, and he's never insensitive to that argument, but also remake our young men and turn ourselves into the kind of nation we can be proud of. And that's the kind of argument that that he makes, conflating the nation and the individual and confusing moral and physical courage. All of these things are going on, it seemed to me, in the early part of this 21st century, too, in the wake of 9/11. There was a lot of talk about the ennobling powers of war to redeem us from our commercial torpor of the 1990s. And, of course, this talk was usually carried on by men who were quite safe and quite remote from the battlefield themselves. So it's all vicarious. And this is the kind of thing that fuels militarist fantasy in this period between the Civil War and World War One. It's not confined to the U.S. It's out there, and obviously in Germany and Italy and Great Britain, France, and it leads to the First World War and the belief that the experience of war can morally regenerate a nation in Europe as well. And ultimately, of course, it survives, but only in a very extreme form after the war, and revives itself in fascism and Nazism. So it's not peculiar to the United States, but it takes a particular form coming out of our Civil War and feeding on our Protestant traditions and our faith in our own providential mission to save the world.
And finally, you touched on this a little bit already, but our country right now looks very ravaged and tired and troubled and exhausted, and we tried the regeneration through violence in the Bush years. That didn't seem to have worked well. So is there anything left to this ideology of regeneration that might get us through the coming decades, or are we kind of tired out as a culture?
Well, I hope there's something left. I really thought that the Obama campaign was addressing widespread longings for a different kind of regeneration, and what I would consider a more genuine and certainly more benign version of moral regeneration, and in some ways a recognition that we are one people, we are a commonweal, and that we are not just a nation of individual self-seekers, but that we have responsibilities to one another as well. And in certain ways, then, Obama represented a revival of that progressive impulse from the early 20th century, the social Christianity, though, of course, it's much more pluralistic than that version 100 years ago, and rhetorically, at least, includes Jews and Muslims and Hindus and secular folk, and anybody who is a member of this commonweal deserves to be included and taken care of to a certain extent, to the extent we're able as a society to do that. That seems to me the impulse that elected Obama. Whether he will be able to carry forward on it is another question, because he's facing the same kinds of legislative complexities and the need to build coalitions and make compromises and keep allies that the populists and progressives faced 100 years ago. And you know more about these things than I do on the Wall Street front these days, but you're familiar, I'm sure, and probably made it yourself with the criticism of his fairly tepid response to the to the financial crisis.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Larry Summers and Tim Geithner leading us to the promised land.
Exactly. I mean, this is not likely. And so I fear disappointment. I fear what comes out of disappointment. If there is a widespread public disappointment, then I think the right wing is still waiting and ready to exploit the anger that will be out there if this recession deepens and continues. There, of course, are always external enemies that we can conjure up, and we can go off and fight them, and that will distract people for a while. That was certainly the argument that was made 100 years ago, quite openly, by frightened men of property. You know, let's get ourselves a good war and distract the working classes from their misery. And of course, it succeeded for a variety of reasons. Not least of which was that the economy began to improve, too, so the working class were not quite as miserable as they had been. So we will see what happens about that. I think Obama is tremendously smart and able, and that he does have a lot of good people around him. Not everyone is the sort of person I would have chosen, but some of them are, and so I have at least some hope there, but I think we need to keep the pressure on him, too.
I'm not sure exactly who this we is and how we're going to keep that pressure on Obama, but so much for that. Anyway, I've been speaking with Jackson Lierz, author of the book Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of Modern America, 1877 and 1920, just out from Harper's. Lierz is a professor of history at Rutgers and editor of the journal Raritan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with this. Asatid is back. From Felakot featuring Moff, and I know nothing more about it than that it's Iranian hip hop and it sounds great. Till next week, bye.
دستی نبودم و فکر میکردی پنج شدم ولی نمیذارم راحت بگا به رهنج شدم استیلم اتفا کنه چه عزیده که سرده میشه و آجی تو مده تو فاید تو بعد برینه بگو اساسیت یه خانه بازم خانه ما از بدوره با خانه بازم با اراده حال ما را خاله بانم نمیتونه بگیره با خواه بازم خواه دارم پاره پاره جلو بری تو
با تو دستوری هستم تو میتونی که ما باید توری نمونه فکرمی که راحت باشی به فلاکت و ماه منم وقتی
علیه با پایز را تو میزنه و میخونه و میسوزی تا دیگره تو میکنی تا پیرنه تو تازه دیدی چی داره تو مالیده و کیه رفا گایده
بگو اساتید حالا دیگه مادرش رو گایده بگو اساتید حالا دیگه مادرش رو گایده